wood than he could use in 2 years. He had 10 rain barrels running along the side of his house, and another 10 on his neighbor's house to catch water. Todd and his family were outfitted for the upcoming winter. There was not a single item he or Emily could imagine they would need that he had not already found and brought back to the house. Except, of course, other people, and something to occupy their time. Todd could not alleviate the boredom. Emily was becoming a caged animal in the house, wild from not being able to go about her normal routines or leave her neighborhood. She was a social person, much more than Todd. Emily craved friendship, companionship, and excitement. Before the rapture, she was in 2 book clubs, had regular lunches with 3 of her friends, and was a fixture at her kid's school as a board member of the PTA. She also worked full-time as a senior partner for a risk management firm. Todd was happy seeing only his family and remaining at home. Emily needed to be on the move. Her type A personality was stifled by the lack of stimulus. "I want to go today." Emily did not whine. She stated her argument. "You promised if we did not see anyone by today and it was sunny, you'd take me." Emily had ideas about how she could become unbored. She threw the ball to Jay and continued to plead her case. "Let's all go downtown, and we'll just try the front door. If you want to stay here, fine. The kids and I will go. Or maybe I'll go alone, and you and the kids can stay here." She was determined. Todd knew he could not contain her. Not after 2 months of sequestration in their house and yard, with only a few trips around the neighborhood and surrounding areas. "Fine, fine, I give." Todd held his hands above his head in an expression of surrender. "Yay!" Emily cheered and high-fived her children. "We'll pack some snacks, drinks, and go in a little while." Brian, 7, was supposed to be attending 2nd grade. Jay, 6, should have been in 1st. Emily used her energy to homeschool the kids, splitting lessons between reading, writing, math, and survival training. The kids learned how to read, and they learned how long to boil water before they could drink it. They learned how to use fire without getting burned, while also learning how to add 2-digit numbers. Emily alternated between one day of school and one day of fun. She did not have to comply with a traditional calendar. She did what worked for her and the kids. Todd brought a whiteboard home from the nearby office supply store, along with several hundred boxes of markers in a multitude of colors. Today was a day off from school. Emily was tired of staying in the neighborhood. Raleigh was known for its wonderful parks, one of which, Pullen Park, was downtown and had a gas-powered train ride, paddle boats, and playground equipment. She wanted to take the kids on an outing. She wanted the kids to see the governor's mansion, both inside and out, and visit the local library for more books. Todd kept her at bay for a few months, but today was her day to break free. Todd gave Emily a small pistol to keep in her pack. He slipped a large-caliber pistol in his, and off they went. They drove a hybrid SUV before the rapture, and saw no reason to upgrade. One of Emily's favorite things to do before the world ended was touring homes. She loved to attend open houses or go on home and neighborhood tours. It fulfilled her curiosity into how other people lived, and gave her ideas about how to decorate and coordinate her own home. Suddenly, every home in the country was open for a tour. She walked through as many as she could in her neighborhood, and most of the surrounding neighborhoods, only venturing into homes that had a V painted on the driveway. Emily was not weird about touring homes. She understood the horror that preceded her opportunity. But she was bored. She rationalized her sojourns by assuming the identity of an anthropologist. Raleigh was a snapshot in time. The hasty evacuations and lack of looting left homes in pristine condition. Emily walked through houses and enjoyed how people really lived in them. She did not steal from the homes, and she was not looking for decorating ideas. Emily approached the homes as shrines or museums to a dead world. She wanted to tour the governor's mansion for years, having seen pictures of it in a North Carolina magazine. She had a few other places she wanted to check out, too, homes that always caught her eye when she drove by, or homes featured in local magazines and newspaper articles. Todd suspected they would be taking side stops on their trip to and from the park. They had plenty of food and water for the day out. The weather was clear and warm for October, and he felt like the family might enjoy a normal day, or at least a day outside of the neighborhood. Pullen Park was 20 minutes away. One habit that Todd could not shake, even after months of driving on empty streets, was observing the speed limit. He might drive a few miles per hour faster, but if the posted signs read 45 miles per hour, he stayed within that range. He wasn't sure if the habit stayed with him because he had been driving for so long, or because he trusted that the signs were the proper safety speeds. He assumed he would not be driving much past this winter, unless they found an oil well and a person who could refine oil into gasoline. Their hybrid SUV used batteries at lower speeds. Fuel was abundant, but Todd still conserved when possible. The process to siphon gas from other tanks was time-consuming and dirty. He drove slowly down the road towards the park. The windows were down. His arm rested on the open frame. Jay and Brian were ecstatic to get out of the neighborhood. While Emily ventured on house tours, and Todd explored the town for safety and scavenged for food, the two boys had not left the cul-de-sac or backyard for 3 months. A television show played on the car entertainment system, but the kids ignored the media and opted for the view outside of the car window. "Where is everyone?" Jay asked. "Is it Sunday morning or something? Why are there no other cars?" Todd and Emily looked at each other. 3 months of telling the boys that people were gone and their friends were not around anymore was obviously not specific enough. The 6-year-old could not grasp the idea that everyone was dead. It was difficult enough for Todd and Emily to comprehend. "Honey," Emily started, "we talked about this. Everyone is gone. Remember watching all of the cars leave that day you were sick? Remember watching the television and hearing about how everyone was getting sick?"
"Yeah, but everyone?"
Brian responded with amazement.
"I just thought maybe they all left for a while and were coming back."
"You mean everyone is dead?
You think Charlie is dead too?"
Charlie was Brian's best friend at school. Todd stopped the car and placed it in park. He turned around to look at his sons. "Guys, I don't know if everyone is dead, but they probably are. I'm sorry if Mom and I were not clear about this, but it's one of those times that parents try to protect their kids from bad stuff. I know 2 months ago your cousins and uncles were alive. If we are alive and they are alive, maybe other people survived too. But no one here in Raleigh did. I've been around the city for the last month, up and down streets, blasting music, yelling for people. There isn't anyone alive that I can find." There was a quiet moment as the boys processed the information. They were sad, but they seemed to understand and process the information.
"So the power is never coming back? We're never going to have TV again?"
That was the response of a 6-year-old. "No, probably not. It depends on who survived, and if anyone who survived knows how to fix things and get electricity going again. As for TV, well, we can use it sometimes. We have power for that, and Mom and I have all the DVDs for all the shows we could find, so we have, like, 50 years of TV to watch."
"Can we just go to the park? I want to feed the ducks."
Jay was not a patient child, particularly when the discussion was topics about death and not having TV. Todd turned around and started downtown. He spoke over his shoulder to the boys. "Mom wants to go on a house tour. Do you want to go before or after the park?"
"Seriously? We get out of the house for the first time in like 10 years and we have to do a house tour? Really?"
Brian was 7 going on 13. His cheeks were wet with tears, but his sadness was quickly replaced with outrage. "We can drop Mom off at the house and go to the park ourselves. She could call us when she's done, and we'll come back and get her, or she can walk over." Todd was not interested in the house tour either.
"Now it's my turn to say seriously?"
Emily looked at Todd, who stared at the road instead of making eye contact. You want to leave your wife alone in a dead city. That's how you want to play this. Do you want time to enjoy the mansion, or do you want the 15 minutes you'll get if we all come? I can drop you off. Use the long-range walkie-talkies. Let me know if there's a problem. Everyone has a fun afternoon. There's a bike shop downtown. Just grab one of the bikes from the store and pedal over. It's like 3 miles. You have protection in your bag. The mace, or the other thing. Oh, I can do this. I know that. But I'm letting it sink in that you would rather drop me off, abandon me alone in the city, than do a house tour with me. Despite her complaining, Emily knew Todd was proposing the best solution. She was not worried or scared. She milked the situation as much as possible. "Looks like we're dropping Mom off," Todd said excitedly to the boys. "Yay!" they both yelled. "I just want to make sure you do one thing for me," Emily said to Todd as he drove. "What's that?" Todd asked, looking over at her. "I want duck for dinner. So after you feed them, they feed us." "I'm way ahead of you," Todd said with a smile. The kids settled into a TV show in the back seat and did not pay attention to the last exchange. Todd and Emily grinned as they drove the rest of the way downtown in silence. They pulled up to the governor's mansion within 10 minutes. "Okay, it's 10 a.m. Do you want us to meet you back here at noon? We can go to Marble's Kids Museum as long as we're down here." Todd wanted a plan to get him away from the outdoor park in a reasonable amount of time. "Let's do this. I'll meet you in front of Marble's on the square at noon. I'll call you on the walkie-talkie if I need to get picked up sooner. But plan on being there for lunch. The kids can play in Marble's after lunch." Marble's Kids Museum was a large indoor amusement area. Emily was not sure how much light would be present without electricity, but they would give it a try. Emily opened her door and got out. She walked to the back of the SUV to get her backpack. Todd met her at the trunk. "There isn't anyone here, but be careful. You have a gun. As long as it isn't me or the kids, I don't care if you shoot anyone. Seriously, kill them if you have to. I want to make sure you're safe when I come around the corner at noon." Todd helped Emily put on her pack before giving her a hug and a kiss. "There's no one left to kill. I'll be okay. Don't let the kids get hurt. We don't have an emergency room to take them to. I'll see you in 2 hours. She spun around and walked toward the mansion's gate. It was closed, but not locked. The iron hinges creaked when she swung the doors apart. Todd got in the car, clicked on his walkie-talkie, and pressed the button. "Testing." Emily's voice crackled 2 seconds later. "Works fine. Love you." "Love you too." He put the car in drive and pulled away. The kids watched their video, oblivious their mother was gone from their sight for the first time in 3 months. Emily watched Todd and the boys pull away from the curb. "Okay," she said to herself. "You're on your own now." She walked up to the door of the mansion. There was a large knocker and a doorbell. She lifted the knocker several times, letting it fall heavily onto the door with a loud thump. She yelled, "Hello? Is anyone home?" She ignored the doorbell. There was no electricity. After 5 drops of the knocker, she tried the door. It was locked. Emily knew the mansion was vacant. The governor fled Raleigh at the onset of the epidemic, moving to her western residence in Asheville, announcing she would govern the state from there until a cure was found and she and her family could safely return to the capital. The staff evacuated as well. Emily walked around the mansion to try other entrances before she broke a window. She went back down the front steps and turned to her left. She noticed a carport on the left side of the building and thought the service door might be unlocked. Emily looked at the grounds as she made her way to the second entrance. What was once beautiful and manicured was now overgrown with weeds and out of control. Vegetation grows quickly in North Carolina. Without weekly weed control and pruning, the mansion gardens and grounds were ruined. She arrived at the carport and turned the knob. "Success!" she said aloud as the door pulled open. She stepped into the mansion's mudroom. She peered through the door on the other side of the small vestibule. She could see a sitting room on the right and a dining room to her left. The house was dim, but not dark enough to need a flashlight. Built in the late 1800s, before electric light, its windows were large and illuminating. Emily opened the door on the other side of the mudroom and was met by a funk so powerful she questioned whether she could continue. Not only was the stench repugnant, she was not keen on the prospect of stumbling into rotting corpses. She stood in the doorway for a moment. The smell was different than decomposition. She smelled bodies in her travels during the last month. Rotting corpse was an easy smell for her to recognize. The mansion smell was more a combination of rotting food and poop. Emily imagined a huge diaper pail left overflowing during the evacuation. A refrigerator left open or food left out would account for half of the smell. While hard to believe rotting food would continue to smell for the 3 months since the mansion was abandoned, Emily guessed it was possible. The poop smell was a mystery. "A sewer backup?" she asked herself. "I'm here. I can't let a little odor stop me. If nothing else, I'll open a few windows as I go." She pressed onward, walking into the sitting room on her right. It was decorated in uncomfortable Victorian furniture, leaning heavily on style over substance. "I wouldn't want to sit in this room too long, or try to enjoy a movie or television on the furniture," she mumbled. It was beautiful furniture, but the straight backs and high arms were unwelcoming. The first floor was designed for state dinners and receptions, not comfort. If the first family of North Carolina wanted to host a Super Bowl party, they would have a room full of sectionals rather than ottomans and ornate sofas. Emily spent several minutes touching the furniture, sitting on the couches and chairs, examining the lamps and artwork, but her tour was rushed. She could not ignore the stench. She walked to a window, pulled the pane open, and stuck her head outside for fresh air. "Maybe I can get a crosswind," she thought. She pulled her head back inside and walked towards the dining room on the other side of the hall. She was between the sitting room and the dining room when she heard the scratch. She froze, standing motionless in the hall for what felt like an hour before she heard it again. Another scratch. The sound was nearby. It came again from the left side of the house and appeared to emanate from the dining room. Emily unslung her pack and took out her mace. She looked at the gun sitting at the bottom of the open cavity next to a bottle of water, as if it were natural to carry water, mace, and a gun for a tour of a governor's mansion. She was staring at the gun when she heard the scratch again. She pulled the pistol out and held it in her left hand. The mace was in her outstretched right hand for immediate use. She took a step into the dining room. It was magnificent. A gorgeous chandelier hung from the ceiling over the most beautiful table and chairs Emily had ever seen. The dining set was probably made by one of the many furniture artisans of North Carolina. There was an enormous fireplace on the left wall. Emily imagined heating the room on cold winter nights in 1895 with a roaring fire. Between the portico Emily was standing under and the fireplace in the far corner was a door. It was a swinging door, Emily could tell from the hinges. Emily heard the scratch again and saw the bottom of the door move towards her ever so slightly. The smell was stronger as she stepped in the room and towards the door. She looked at the top of the door and saw a bolt locking it shut from her side. Whatever was making the scratching sound was prevented from getting through the door by the bolt. "Okay, what should I do?" she thought to herself. "It can't be a person. A person would break a window or get out some other way. If it's a raccoon or squirrel or whatever, well, I don't feel like getting rabies and dying myself. The best thing to do is probably leave the house." Her right hand remained straight in front of her with the pepper spray pointed at the door. She heard a whimper and another scratch. It was not the hiss of a raccoon or a possum. It was the whimper of an animal that needed help and knew the sound of human feet. Emily hesitated. She placed the pepper spray on the table, took her pack off, and returned the gun. She picked the spray up as another scratch hit the door. "Whatever it is, the pepper spray will work," she told herself. I'll slide the door open and see what's back there. Bad animal? Pepper spray. Nice animal? Well, I'll figure it out. Emily pulled a chair from the table, positioning it for a quick jump up. If the mace did not work, she would leap onto the chair and then the table. She put her hand on the bolt at the top of the door and slid it down. A final scratch pushed the door open slightly. Emily grabbed the edge and pulled the swinging door towards her. The smell was incredible. Feces and rancid food flooded her nose. She was almost knocked back, but she kept her eyes open and the pepper spray at the ready. Lying on the ground was a dog. It was almost dead, its ribs showing as it breathed shallowly. It lay on its side inches from the swinging door. Emily knelt down and looked at the poor creature. It was a white bulldog. She guessed it was a beautiful specimen before being locked in a room for months. She looked into the kitchen and saw a once majestic room completely destroyed. Animal excrement covered everything. The dog managed to pry open a pantry door left slightly ajar. It pawed cupboards and ate all the food it could find. Emily stepped over the dog to find a bowl. The kitchen's cabinets were glass front. How can people keep their shelves this orderly? She mused as she found a pasta bowl. She walked back to the poor animal and stroked its head. It's okay. She paused and looked between the dog's legs. Boy, here's some water. You're okay now. You're okay. She went to her pack for a bottle of water and poured some on the dog's mouth. It licked the air. She moved the dish towards the licking tongue. The dog caught on quickly. It was too weak to sit up, but it lifted its head slightly to drink. That's right. Drink the water. I'll find you some food. She looked for canned food fit for a dog. The smell was beginning to get to her, and she frantically opened doors looking for the pantry. She found two cans of salmon, and after flipping open three drawers, she found a can opener. Emily grabbed several bowls from the cabinet before walking out of the dining room. The bulldog stopped drinking and lay on its side. Emily went outside. She breathed in deeply. The fresh fall air cleared her nose and rid her mouth of the horrendous taste associated with the kitchen. She regained her senses, opened the can of salmon, and dumped it into a bowl. She filled a second bowl with water. She took a deep breath of the fresh air before walking back into the mansion to the dog. Its eyes were closed, and it panted slowly. You're okay, big fella. Don't worry, you're okay. She stroked its head. Emily had to pick up the dog and take him to the food. It needed to be out of the foul air and in the sunshine and fresh fall day. The problem was the dog was covered in crap. It was literally covered in its own feces and rotten food. Emily was not a priss, nor did she want to pick up a poop-covered dog, soiling her clothes and hands in the process. She looked for a tablecloth or towels, something that she could wrap the poor dog in and shield her hands from the gook that covered him. Nothing was in sight. She walked back to the Victorian sitting room and spied a throw. She grabbed what was probably a priceless cashmere blanket and returned to the dog. His eyes were still closed. She gently put the edge of the blanket against its back, grabbed its legs, and rolled him on the blanket. Emily pulled the blanket across the hardwood, sliding the dog gently out of the kitchen and into the dining room. She shut the swinging door to block the smell. She leaned over and picked up the blanket-wrapped dog, taking him to the food and water bowls. The dog opened his eyes and did not struggle. She gently placed the dog on a mat by the back door. She pulled the bowl of salmon next to his face, pinching a piece of fish in her fingers and placing it next to the dog's mouth. The dog opened his mouth and chewed weakly. Once the fish was in his mouth, his eyes opened wide. He put his face in the bowl of food and ate quickly. The fish was gone in a few seconds. Emily was afraid another can would make the dog sick, particularly on his empty stomach. She pushed the water bowl into the salmon bowl's place, and the dog drank. He finished the bowl of water before looking up at Emily. "That's enough for now, buddy. Let's get you over to the museum, see if they have water pressure, and maybe we can get you another drink. You're definitely taking a bath to get that funkiness off of you. The dog tried to get up, but he was too weak. It lay back down. His legs wobbled as he tried to stand again before collapsing a second time. I got you, big guy. Don't worry, I got you. Emily reached down and picked up the dog. It should have weighed 50 pounds or more, but he was at most 25. The fish gave the dog some energy, not enough strength to walk, but the salmon put a light in his eyes. Bulldogs do not have tails. This dog had a little nub that Emily could see moving back and forth. The dog was happy. She slipped the water bowl into her pack, put the pack on her back, and leaned over to pick up the dog. She kept the throw between herself and the nastiness. It's not far. I can carry you, Emily said to the dog's face. And even if that water is cold, you are getting a bath. Marbles has water stations where kids play. They're perfect for washing a little doggy like you. Emily spent a lot of time at the Marbles Kids Museum with her two boys. She knew the layout inside and out. She hoped she could find soap. She made her way down the four blocks to the kids museum, talking to her new pet along the way. She went to the corner of the museum that faced the park and the arranged meeting place with Todd and the boys. Emily put the dog on the sidewalk and turned to face the museum. She had little hope of finding an open door. The museum was locked up tightly. Emily contemplated which door to break and how to break it. The museum had glass doorways on three of its sides. The door in front of her, the main entrance, passed through a gift shop. Emily remembered the gift shop had a chain-link door separating it from the rest of the museum. She and Todd attended a fundraiser at the museum. The gift shop was sealed off. She walked to the door, cupping her hands against the glass to peer into the shop. She saw the chain mesh on the other side. I can't get through that, she said over her shoulder to the dog. She decided to try a door on the side of the building next to the museum's garden. Not only was the door near the water stations and kitchen Emily needed to wash the dog, but there was a slight chance the door might be unlocked. Okay, I'm going to pick you up again, little buddy. One more time before your bath. Even in the fresh air, the dog smelled. She bent down and picked him up, walking quickly around the building to the garden area. She held the dog away from her face and walked through the dead garden to the side door. Emily saw the giant wooden pirate ship and submarine on the other side of the glass. She tried the door. It was locked. Emily's other reason for selecting this door was the large rocks the garden staff used as decorative bordering. Emily put the dog down several feet from the door. It's going to be loud, but it's okay. She picked up a rock and threw it at the door. It did not go through the safety-enforced glass, but it made a small hole and spiderwebbed the door. She picked the rock up and threw it again. This time the rock went through. Emily kicked the glass away from the frame. I'll find a broom and sweep that away from the pirate ship, don't worry, she said to the dog. She went through the door by ducking under the handlebar that went across the middle. She kicked the large pieces of safety glass out of her way and walked to the water stations she hoped to use for a dog bath. She could not find a knob or valve to turn on the water. Damn it, she muttered. After a few minutes of futility, she opted for Plan B, a kitchen sink. The kitchen was next to the pirate ship. It was an interior room, windowless, and pitch black. She opened the kitchen door and tested her flashlight to see if it gave her enough light to work. Well, it's not ideal, but it will have to do. She was pleased to see the sink was large enough for the dog. The sink's faucet sputtered, coughed built-up air, and flowed. I win, she said softly. Emily looked in the cabinet under the sink and found dish soap. And it's lemon. She put a stopper in the bottom of the sink, squirted soap, and walked outside to her new friend. She examined the glass door for a knob to open the lock, but it required a key on both sides. She ducked under the handle. Okay, buddy. The dog had not moved. He was asleep and snoring. This is going to be a harsh wake-up. She picked him up, maneuvered through the door and under the handle, walked into the kitchen, and put the dog blanket and all, into the sink of cold water. Emily rolled up her sleeves to minimize how dirty she would get and rubbed the soapy water all over the dog. The dog was too weak to fight. He stayed in the sink and took the abuse. There was a collar around his neck Emily refused to touch until now. It slid over the dog's head easily, a testament to how much weight the poor animal lost during his imprisonment. Emily washed him 3 times, draining the sink with each bath. After the 3rd bath, she was happy with the condition of the dog. He was clean and almost fit to be in their car. He just needed to get dry. She picked the wet and disgusting cashmere blanket off the floor and threw it into the trash. She sighed. "Your last use was a noble one, expensive cashmere blanket." Emily moved the flashlight around the kitchen and saw a metal storage closet in the corner. "Bingo," she said as she opened the locker and found stacks of towels. She grabbed an armful and went back to the sink. The dog was asleep in the bottom. "You don't let a little adventure get in the way of your nap time, do you?" Emily whispered to him. She used 2 towels to dry him off in the sink. She spread other towels on the ground, gently picked the dog up from the sink and setting him on the ground. He slept as she rubbed him dry. Emily let him sleep on the pile of towels. "Grab it while you can," she told him. "You're about to meet 2 young boys who will not leave you alone for the rest of your life." She looked back at the sink and picked up the dog's collar. She did not touch it directly. She used a towel to avoid the grime. The tag read, "Hubba, first dog of North Carolina." "I would have thought Georgia's first dog would be a bulldog, not North Carolina's. Shouldn't ours be a hound of some kind?" "Whatever. Hubba it is." She looked down at the snoring beast. "So, Hubba, my name is Emily. Welcome to our family." Hubba continued to nap. "That seems about right," Emily responded. "While you get some well-deserved rest, I'm going to see if there's some sort of stroller or cart I can use to move you around until we get home. You are a little heavy and damp to carry. Stay here." She chuckled at the idea of him moving. "I'll be back." Emily took the flashlight and headed off to the rest of the museum. She needed options for transporting Hubba. There were toys in a big play area of the museum, a canvas postal bin her kids used for toy packages in a mailroom area, or toy shopping carts used in the supermarket area. Neither option was ideal, but both could work. Emily hoped to find a better solution. She bypassed the play area for the front desk. She looked for strollers, but she could not remember if the museum rented umbrella strollers to parents. She was out of luck. Emily peered through the metal door of the gift shop for anything that might be useful. There were a lot of toys, some snack foods and drinks, but nothing that would help her transport an enfeebled dog. She went to the play area, resigned to the idea of the postal cart. The toy shopping carts were too low to the ground. Emily did not want to bend over as she pushed. The 1st-floor play space was enclosed by a 4-foot-high wall used to keep children from wandering away. The entry door had a clasp at the top accessible to tall people. Next to the entry gate was a short school bus. The bus was complete with a steering wheel and 3 rows of seats. The back was open, and a slide flowed into the play space. Kids entered the bus door on one side of the wall and slid into the play area. "What the hell?" Emily said. She walked onto the bus and slid into the large fun room. The walled area was enormous. There was a fire truck, a flat-bottomed boat, a kitchen, a dress-up area with a stage. Her 2 boys loved playing in the space for hours. The postal station was in the far corner from her. Emily walked through, stopping briefly to examine the once beautiful fish tank, littered with algae and fish bones. The mock postal room had a conveyor belt with rollers and fake packages. Children could fill a canvas bin with boxes by sliding the packages along the conveyor. Emily looked at the cart. It was deep, and the bottom looked uncomfortable, but if she put blankets or towels in the bottom, it would work to transport Hubba. She grabbed the cart and rolled it towards one of the play space exits. She passed a puppet station. She stopped and put all the puppets into the bottom of the cart. She found stuffed animals from the storeroom and put them in the bottom. She ripped down the thick velvet curtains used on a small stage to lay across the top. The car looked like a rolling royal purple pillow. A bed fit for the first dog of North Carolina, Emily said as she approached the kitchen. Hubba was out of the kitchen and sleeping on the blue ocean carpet of the pirate ship. He snored in the sunlight. You seem to be doing okay for a dog that I found half dead an hour ago. Hubba opened one eye and lifted his head. He looked like he was happy. He put his head back down and started snoring again. Emily rolled the royal bed over to him, picked him up, and placed him onto the purple velvet. He didn't have the strength to stand up on the pillows. He stayed on his side, looking at Emily with his big brown eyes. She checked her watch. It was 11:55. She walked to the kitchen to get her backpack. When she got back to the cart, Hubba was laying on his stomach, arms stretched out in a sphinx pose. He looked ready for the ride. Here we go, Hubba. She pushed the cart over the broken glass, under the metal arm, and out the door. She pushed him all the way down to the street, across the road, and to the park to meet Todd. It was noon. The always punctual Todd pulled around the corner. Emily whispered into Hubba's ear, "Your life is about to change for the better." Her husband rolled the window down. He raised an eyebrow at the dog sitting on a purple pillow in a canvas mail cart. Hubba looked like a large chihuahua with a bulldog face. His skin showed every rib. Screams came from the back seat.
"A dog! A dog! Mom got us a dog!"
Todd deadpanned, "We're both supposed to have input before purchasing a family pet."
"He came free with the mansion tour."
"You've always wanted a dog and you know it. Let's make a stop at a pet store and get some food. Marbles will have to wait for another day. I want to get him home. He's pretty frail." "Did you give him a bath? He looks wet. Where did you find him? You know how crazy it is that you found a dog?" Todd was full of questions. Emily was not answering.
"Does he have a name, Mom? Can I name him, can I?"
Brian spoke excitedly. "He does have a name. It's Hubba, and he is the first dog of North Carolina."
"Hubba!"
the kids yelled. Hubba was scared by the screams. He backed towards the corner of the postal bin furthest from the screaming children.
"Okay, let's calm down. I'll tell you all about my adventure on the way home. The dog is scared and weak, so you have to be quiet. I'm going to hold Hubba on the way home so he feels safe."
"Oh, my God," Todd muttered, rolling his eyes. "A royal pillow cart, and now you hold him on the way home? I just met the dog, and he's already spoiled."
"That's enough out of you. Could you please get a towel out of the back that I can use to hold him?"
Todd retrieved a towel and gave it to Emily. He opened the door as she gently picked up Hubba and got into the seat with the dog on her lap. Todd closed the door for her. He walked back around and got into the car.
"I'm excited to hear the story of how you were dropped off for a mansion tour 2 hours ago and end up with a clean, wet bulldog named Hubba."
"Before I start, did you all have a nice time?"
Emily turned to face the boys.
"Dad killed 3 ducks, gutted them right in front of us. It was nasty,"
Jay said, scrunching up his face to show his disgust.
"There were a bunch of cars, so he was able to fill our tank with gas and fill the spare can on the back."
Brian liked to talk about stealing gas, even though Todd and Emily explained that it was not stealing anymore.
"He got the train to work, too."
The best part of their trip was relegated to an afterthought.
"The train works? That sounds like fun we can have many more times."
Emily patted Todd's shoulder. He wore a smile of pride and accomplishment. Emily paused before she began. She used her best storytelling voice.
"My adventure begins when I opened the door to the governor's mansion. I was hit by a smell so bad I could barely breathe."
The car was riveted by her story, everyone but Hubba, who was asleep and snoring in Emily's arms the entire ride home. He did not wake up when Todd stopped at a pet store and loaded 5 40-pound bags of food into the truck.
The dog did not wake up when they pulled into the driveway of his new house. Hubba snored against Emily, his savior and new master, and dreamed happily about his new family.
17. Rebecca was exceptionally smart. She was 13 years old and a senior in high school. Her genius was a gift and a burden. She did not attend school with children her own age. She studied at the local high school. Girls and boys her age were still in 7th or 8th grade. She had eaten lunch by herself since she was 5 years old and identified as gifted. She did not mind not having friends in school. School was for learning, but not having friends after school and on the weekends was hard. Her parents convinced the school board to allow her to play 8th grade volleyball despite her high school status. Volleyball only got her close to girls her own age, not boys. She started to like boys when she was 12, but she had a hard time meeting ones her age. She had one semester of high school to complete and was accepted to several universities with full academic scholarships for the winter semester. She was deciding on location more than institution. Did she want to be in Northern California? Did she want to stay close to home in Boston? Did she want to stay on the East Coast in Baltimore? Despite the big life decisions she had to make, Rebecca's mind was consumed with meeting boys her age. She was a cute 13-year-old with dark red hair and pretty greenish hazel eyes. She did not go through an awkward phase like many girls. She was average height with an athletic body and developing into a woman in all the right places. She had confidence which showed through in her actions and personality. She sat alone at lunch, not because she was an outcast, but because she wanted to read, study, or think about her next steps. Rebecca had plans. She always had plans, and she made them happen for herself. The one puzzle she could not solve was how to meet boys, cute boys her age, and it frustrated her. She had aspects of her life she could not control. She controlled her grades and her classes, but she could not control where she took the classes. High school was for older boys. She was young. She had no solution. After Christmas, the problem would get worse. College boys were even older. Rebecca spent most lunches staring off into space, thinking about her boy problem rather than focusing on her studies. When the plague struck Sao Paulo, Brazil, in June, Rebecca knew it was trouble. She brought it up at dinner with her parents. "Did you see all those people are sick in Brazil? It looks weird, like some sort of flu." Despite owning a local grocery store open until 10 p.m., Rebecca and her parents had family dinner together at least 4 nights a week. "It's winter in Brazil, isn't it? Isn't that a different hemisphere? I'm sure it's just some winter flu epidemic." Her mother was a great mom who always tried to calm her daughter's fears. "That's pretty far away from here, too, Squirt. I'd be more worried about making the V-ball team this fall than a flu in Brazil." Her father was volleyball crazy.
"Dad, I bet this gets more press. Why don't we order some extra canned goods and bottled water, extra dry goods, dried fruit, jerky, those kinds of things? I bet people will want to buy survival stuff if the flu gets worse. We can always keep it in the storage basement if it doesn't sell right away."
"You have an opportunistic business mind, Rebecca. I'll put the order in after dinner." Her dad beamed at her with pride. He loved that his daughter thought about his business. He did not realize her ulterior motives. Rebecca followed medical blogs and chats every night. She knew Sao Paulo was not normal. Doctors could not connect the people who died. Their symptoms were odd. Panic alarms were going off in the private medical blogosphere. 3 weeks later, Raleigh, North Carolina went through an outbreak. South America was a giant hot zone on the news station maps. Africa was a hot zone. Europe was painted with red circles. Asia had red circles. Rebecca stayed calm and followed the blogs and chat rooms. She wrote down the identified symptoms. She tried to figure out a pattern, a way to avoid the flu or
the rapture as it was being called. The news spoke of an impending cure. The internet said otherwise. One night in July, just before the epidemic spread outside of Raleigh, Rebecca hacked into her favorite private medical chat room. It was populated with MDs researching the disease. Rebecca loved contributing when possible. She was reading the conversation when a virologist posted, "Testing theory of 6 to 9 month dormancy, possibly year. If true, we're all dead. SP, Brazil." Concluding same. Need cure, not vaccine. All infected. P, France. Agreed. We are screwed. B, China. Rebecca knew one of two things would happen. Either she would die, or she would live while everyone else got sick. She had been different all her life. Exceptional. She continued to make plans to survive. The first symptom of the rapture was lack of appetite. It was the only indication of infection before the major symptoms of fever, lethargy, and euphoria began 2 weeks before, or as little as 5 days before death. People focused on the fever because it was easy to diagnose. Rebecca wondered when a person lost their appetite. Was it when they contracted the disease? Was it a late-stage symptom? She had access to data. Her family's grocery store sales. Sales could indicate a decline in food purchasing for the area and the onset of the disease. Her father did not share the store's sales volumes with her, but he did not password protect his computer either. She snuck into his office the day after she read the disturbing chatroom posts. She pulled the last 3 months of sales. June was 10% lower than May. July was 15% lower than June. Not only did the sales figures explain her father's somber mood for the last 2 months, the numbers indicated most of the people in the area had the rapture. Rebecca pulled up the last year of sales. July of last year, the store had double the sales of this July. She studied the past 24 months. 2 summers ago, the store's sales grew each month from July through January, peaking in December. Holiday sales drove the increase over the last 6 months of each year. Last July to August showed a small increase month over month until October. Sales were flat in November and December, and declined steadily each month after the new year. February showed a modest dip of 4%. March dropped 7%. April dropped 7.5%. May dropped 8%. Rebecca attended advanced classes during the summer. It was technically summer school. Most kids who attended had to attend. Rebecca did not daydream about boys during lunch anymore. She watched the other kids eat. Except they did not actually eat. They talked and acted normally. Kids ate pudding or applesauce. A bag of chips might be opened, but no one ate anything of substance. Rebecca observed the same at dinner. Her mother made spaghetti and meatballs, but neither of her parents finished their plates. Rebecca ate all of her dinner. Her parents threw most of theirs away. Rebecca found Tupperware upon Tupperware in the fridge. Most of the previous week's meals were in plastic containers, untouched. Her parents, like the kids at school, ate enough to survive, but not much more. "Hey, Dad," Rebecca said to her father, walking into his study later that night. He stared at the computer, most likely fretting over the grocery's sales numbers. He looked frail in the computer monitor light. Rebecca suddenly noticed how much weight he had lost. He perked up when she came in the room. "What's up, Squirt?" Her dad loved her. She could tell every time they spoke. "Well, I was thinking about inventory at the store. I know I talked you into ordering more stuff, and I've noticed that you haven't needed me to restock too much lately." He interrupted her. "Yeah, I think this flu thing has people scared to shop, but it'll turn. I mean, people have to eat, right?" She gave a laugh, which was fake, but the appropriate response to her dad's comment.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I know people have to come back in full force eventually. While it's a little slow, do you mind if I work through the expiration dates on the food, put the stuff that is closest to expiring upstairs, and move some of the further from expiring in the lock room downstairs? People are going to need food, a lot of food soon. I bet we can make this lull work to our advantage, move older inventory. I was thinking of raising the price a nickel on each item, something really small, but will help our bottom line. The pride in her father's face was noticeable, and his smile was ear to ear. If you want to do that, I think it's a great idea. He opened his arms, the universal sign for gimme a hug. Rebecca ran over and jumped into his arms. She hugged him tightly. I love you, Daddy, she cried softly. I love you too, honey. I love you too. Rebecca spent Saturday and Sunday moving inventory to the lock room in the basement of their store. She convinced her father to leave the shelves a little bare, a marketing technique to make people believe the store was running out of food. He loved the idea. Rebecca moved more food to the basement. 1 week later, the disease spread outside of Raleigh, and the store shelves were sold out. The first cases of the rapture hit Concord, New Hampshire on a Wednesday. Panic ensued, and people flocked to the store for provisions. Rebecca and her father did not have time to restock their shelves. The market staff did not show for work that day, or ever again. Rebecca's mother was at home, weak and feverish. Her father did not look much better. He hid his symptoms well. Friday, he was too weak to get out of bed. Most of the people in Rebecca's subdivision fled. Where they went, she did not know. The houses on either side of her were empty. Rebecca's parents were too sick to travel. "We have an idea, Squirt," her father said as she brought soup to their bedside. "Your mother and I want you to help us move to the Johnsons' house. You can take care of us over there. They're gone and have a much bigger television in the bedroom." "Why don't I just bring the television over here?" Rebecca did not like the idea. She knew what her parents were doing. "We can't steal their television, honey. Just move us over there. We're afraid you're going to get sick." Her mother smiled weakly. Rebecca was usually good at separating emotions from practical decisions. She understood her parents did not want to die in the house and leave Rebecca to deal with two dead bodies. She got it. But Rebecca did not want to admit her parents were dying. She also knew she would move out of their house once her parents died. The fireplace was gas. She could not depend on a gas fireplace. "This is your house. You've lived here for 15 years. You should stay here. I can go to the Johnsons, but only if I need to go there. You know what I mean. I don't think I'll need to go, but if I do, well, I'll move over there." Rebecca reached out to hold their hands. "Like you said, they have bigger TVs, and I think they have lots of video games." "What? You suddenly play video games?" her father joked. Rebecca played word games or read on her handheld. She never played video games. "With school closed, I might have to start. Or I can just read. You know I like to read." Rebecca sat on the bed with her parents. They talked all afternoon, laughing and enjoying each other's company. The television broadcast awful stories from all over the world about military crackdowns and government roundups. The promises of a cure were quickly fading. 1 week later, Rebecca was still healthy. "I have a feeling you knew all of this was coming, Squirt," her father said softly. "I know you well enough to know you have a plan, too. But let me say what I want to say anyway. I'll be okay, Dad. Don't worry." Rebecca held her father's hand. Her mother slept beside him. "You put food in the store's basement weeks ago. You had me order the survival food. You are on top of this disease. You were more than a month ahead of everyone. Like you always are, I know. But let me speak."
He sat up in bed. Rebecca helped him place pillows under his back and neck.
Not many people are going to survive. I'm sure you know.
I do, Dad. The number of survivors will be in the dozens, not hundreds or thousands. I won't have to worry about food or shelter. She sat with her parents every day, treasuring the last conversations.
No, you don't understand. Or maybe you do. Food and water will be abundant. Intelligence will be scarce. Genius will be coveted. You can't trust anyone. No one. Do you hear me?
Her father tried to sound forceful, but he was too weak.
When you meet other survivors, and you will meet them, you cannot let them know what you are.
Rebecca giggled. Dad, I'm not a robot. I'm smart, but whatever. He squeezed her hand.
Promise me you will act like a 13-year-old and not what you really are. Survive. Thrive. But keep your secret. You are the most valuable asset left in the world.
Rebecca's face grew serious. She dropped the fake persona she maintained to fit into society and not intimidate people.
Dad, I know. Don't worry. I promise.
Her green eyes fixed on him with a combination of pure intelligence and unwavering confidence. He loosened his grip and continued to hold her hand.
I'm sorry we're leaving you alone.
He reached out with his other hand and stroked her hair.
I love you, Squirt.
Rebecca's parents died one day before their 20th anniversary. They passed within an hour of each other. Rebecca moved into the Johnsons' house before settling in the model home. The genius girl anticipated and planned for every aspect of the rapture, except for one small thing. The disease that killed her parents destroyed the world and took away everything in Rebecca's life, delivered a cute boy, her own age. 18. Greg and Rebecca were on their third day together. Most of what Rebecca told Greg was true. She just framed all of her planning and ingenuity as her parents' ideas. By day three, Greg realized there was far more to Rebecca than her being a bright, or even very bright, 13-year-old.
What grade were you in?
You know, before all of this happened. I was a sophomore. Well, I was about to be a sophomore. I came up to school early to take some prep classes and attend baseball camp. Anything to get out of the South Carolina heat.
I was a senior, she replied.
Rebecca had a new rule. Never lie to Greg.
What? You're only 13. Are you some sort of genius?
Well, I can tell you're a genius. But are you one of those Doogie Howser-type kids? Greg was shocked she had not told him she was a senior.
I guess.
I mean, I was going to college after Christmas.
Wow.
It's weird to say was. Even after all that's happened. I still think of college as a future thing.
Where were you going?
I had yet to decide. I got in everywhere I applied. I think it's because I'm a bit of a Doogie Howser. But I'm old enough to not be a freak. It's not like I'm 8, and colleges don't want me on campus because my parents have to stay with me. At 13, I can navigate college on my own.
At least that's what I thought.
Where were you leaning? Greg had not thought about college or where he wanted to go. He had ideas, but his opinion changed monthly.
Maybe you can help me decide. That could be a fun game for us.
Well, right now, I want to talk about you going to Dartmouth College with me. Dartmouth was in Hanover, New Hampshire, and Greg was anxious to get moving. Rebecca was resistant to leaving Concord. They would not split up the team. One of them had to give. Rebecca folded the sheets on their couches. She folded every morning. Keeping her living area clean was important. She stopped folding and frowned. She wanted to stay with Greg at this house or possibly travel further south. She did not want to drive north in New England in November.
We have to figure this out, don't we?
You and I have to make a decision about